Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer at WNYC. Coming up tomorrow on our show, New York Mets broadcaster Ron Darling. He has a new book, and of course we'll talk about the advent of Citi Field. Wednesday, we start an April series on the 21st century New York skyline. What is the city today after a decade of nonstop building? So a lot to listen for every day at 10 a.m. You may know my next guest, Mary Pfeiffer, from her classic bestseller, Reviving Ophelia, the 1994 book about why teenage girls were falling behind. It revolutionized how America thought about girls and adolescence. She had several bestsellers since, as well as a psychotherapy career, making a real difference in the lives of many, many families. She also took a famous stand in 2006. Did you ever hear about this? She refused an award from the American Psychological Association because the APA acknowledged that some of its members took part in the controversial interrogation techniques at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere. Mary Pfeiffer's has been a life of accomplishment and impact and principle. So why was this woman so unhappy? Mary Pfeiffer's new book answers that question and seeks to serve her readers in a new kind of way. The book is called Seeking Peace, Chronicles of the Worst Buddhist in the World. Hello, Mary. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's really fun to be with you again, Brian.
And I should say that Mary Pfeiffer has been coming on the show since 1994 and is one of my all-time favorite guests.
Bless your heart.
For your thoughtfulness and your smarts. You may not even remember, but in the 90s, you once did a Search for Common Ground segment with us and with a men's movement leader after you wrote your book about girls. And I don't know if you remember that one, but that was brave.
Oh, well, I don't remember it. My life is a blur. You know, since 94, I've probably done 3,000 interviews. So I'm really sad when someone goes, well, do you remember that time I interviewed you in Oklahoma City? And I have to go, I'm sorry, I don't.
And that goes to part of the essence of the book, because it's about your success making you, at least in some ways, depressed, even giving you high blood pressure and heart disease. Is this the classic story of the stress of fame and overwork that we've heard about from so many celebrities of all kinds?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't tell a classic story like that in 2009 with the economic meltdown. There's a lot of people right now under great despair. It's prevalent, if not universal. What it is a story about crisis and recovery. And I fell apart in 2002 for a winter as a result of very, very hard work, getting very tired and pushing myself to just work harder, faster, better. But I really try to make this story not about me, but about us. Because my meltdown was a quiet, polite meltdown. Only my husband knew, not even my friends, not even my children. And I did all that was expected to me. I mention this, Brian, because we never know who among us is quietly falling apart. I think most of us at some point in our lives have some kind of breakdown, and many of us don't tell anyone. So I wrote this book to help people who are lonely and who are wondering if they're pathological, see that what I experienced and what they experience is part of the ordinary human condition.
And what makes you the worst Buddhist in the world?
Now, that's a funny story. I had been meditating, and I came out of my little meditation room, and I start running around like a Tasmanian devil. And I caramelize some onions, and I'm dialing United Airlines about some problem, and I'm mopping my kitchen floor. And while I'm on hold, I say to my husband, you need to do this, you need to do that. And Jim goes, you are the worst Buddhist in the world. And at first that kind of made me mad. But then I thought, well, he's true. I am probably the worst Buddhist in the world. And furthermore, that has ironic potential. I want to say something about the title Seeking Peace, too. That's the subtitle, Chronicles of the Worst Buddhist in the World. I know about seeking peace the way Nelson Mandela knows about freedom. I would never want to be on this show promoting myself as the most peaceful, serene person around. I have sought peace my whole life. And just as Mandela, who was in a prison cell, wrote about freedom, nobody has tried harder to relax or worked with more ardor to achieve serenity. And I note the irony of that statement.
And the paradox of that statement. And another paradox, you wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post this week or this month about being on both sides of the mindfulness path. For example, your husband says he never thought you would get into that new agey stuff because you were so down to earth. So what's it like being on the receiving end of that?
Well, you know, it's very interesting that my mother was a doctor. She didn't put up with complainers, whiners. She was a worker. She believed morality was action and that if you were a good person, you spent every minute of your life helping people. That's what your job was.
And you admit that mindfulness, meditation, New Age spirituality, call it what you will, can become solipsistic. That, in other words, being so attuned to your inner silence can be a form of tuning out rather than tuning in.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my mom's statement when I asked her about Buddhism as a girl was, I don't have much use for people who sit around contemplating their navels and saying, I am the center of the universe. On the other hand, here is what the issue was for me. You know, my life was a Cinderella story, but I wasn't very well equipped to be Cinderella. I'm somebody who's much happier peeling potatoes and washing dishes. As a little girl with busy parents, I had taken on the job of caring for my siblings. My whole life, I have been someone who wants to take care of everybody.
You called you and your sibs feral children.
We grew up pretty much without parents, and I did my best, but I couldn't do a very good job. I was a little girl myself. Oddly enough, after 1994, I found myself in much the same position. I wanted to take care of everybody, but there were too many everybodies. And my life had that same feeling of I can't do what I need to do.
So you take care of your siblings, then you go into psychotherapy practice, you're taking care of more people, you write the book, Reviving Ophelia, and you want to take care of a whole nation of adolescent girls
right.
and their parents.
And I'm perfectly happy with that identity as someone who takes care of other people. In fact, the main change that happened to me in seeking peace, Brian, was not that I stopped taking care of people. Pretty much since I was 12 months old and my brother Jake was born, I've derived great pleasure from caring for people, especially vulnerable people. What I did with seeking peace was invite myself into my own circle of caring. And I've always been somebody who could dish out compassion, but I couldn't take it. And I've allowed myself to be a little kinder and gentler and more self-accepting.
And back to the paradox, because you've been on the dishing out end of this mindfulness, and your husband called you the worst Buddhist in the world, but you write about feeling abandoned when one of your best friends, a feisty, sassy girlfriend, got so Buddhist mindful that she did not lash out when someone was rude to her daughter.
Oh,
talk
exactly.
About being on that side of the line.
Well, I am a total believer in both and. And Buddha actually spoke of the middle way. And I'm someone who thinks it's very important to be present. It's important to learn about your own body. That's one of the things I learned. Before this book, have you ever heard the phrase, I was running around like a head with its chicken cut off? That was me.
Some version
but,
of it.
But for myself, learning to stay present. You know this bumper sticker, having a good time, wish I were here? That applied to me. It was very good training. Now I'm back out in the world. I'm a social activist. I'm a worker bee. There's nothing that makes me happier than being able to work. I have one little story I'd like to tell if I have time. This is an example of how my mind works and the change. So I'm in a sauna at the university. I told myself to sit there 15 minutes. At 10 minutes, I got really, really hot. And I thought to myself, I'm getting out. But then I thought, are you so hedonistic and undisciplined you would get out of a sauna before you were supposed to? And then I thought, wait a minute. Are you so driven and perfectionistic that you can't get out of a sauna when your skin is burning? And then I thought, what are you, so neurotic? You can't even decide if you're perfectionistic or hedonistic enough to walk out of a sauna? And then, this is the progress. I started laughing. And I just go, walk out of this sauna. And once I was out, I did something Thich Nhat Hanh recommends that we do to accept ourselves and love ourselves. I said to myself, I gave myself a hug, and I said, darling, I love you just the way you are.
So you got out of your head.
I
did. And into your heart.
That's right. And I've always been out of my, I've always lived a life of helping hands. I've always loved being a therapist where I listen to and involve myself in the world of other people. So it's new for me to face my own pain and be present.
Did you only get into Buddhism and mindfulness after your meltdown in 2002?
Absolutely. And I wouldn't even call myself a Buddhist. I'd call myself Buddhist. That's what you call yourself if you know a very little bit about Buddhism and are an on and off meditator.
And people from your hometown in Nebraska say you don't look Buddhist.
Oh, my goodness. Being a Buddhist in Nebraska is a very lonely experience. I must say that. I think there's probably about 10 of us, and we all know each other in my state.
How about reviving Ophelia 15 years later? Have things fundamentally changed for adolescent girls in the United States? Have some things really improved as a result of the conversation you helped to start and some things not? Where are we?
You know, that's a good question. And, of course, the answer is yes and no. The one thing I would mention, if I were going to rewrite that book right now, is I would talk about the effect of things like text messaging and cell phones on the ability of people to go inside themselves and problem solve and think internally about the issues of their lives. Because one of the things I notice is from the time children are quite young, they can always be calling their mom and dad. They can always be texting. If a boy walks by a girl and smiles at her, before she even absorbs it, she's texting all her friends and getting their reactions. I think this may have very interesting and serious implications for our ability as humans to problem solve and think.
We just have 20 seconds, but might there also be an upside to that because there's less social isolation with everybody so free to text each other and communicate?
Well, you know, I can't really answer a question that complicated in 20 seconds, but I'll tell you something for sure. I am most happy when I'm looking someone in the eye and physically present with them and able to touch their hand, and I don't think we want to lose that.
Mary Pfeiffer, still thinking, still feeling, still helping. Her new book is called Seeking Peace, Chronicles of the Worst Buddhist in the World. A pleasure again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Megan Ryan, Lisa Allison, Jody Abergan, and Kate Hines produced this program. Annie Schreffler is our Uncommon Economics editor. Don't forget to post your stories, photos, videos to our Uncommon Economic Indicators page at wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Tomorrow, Ron Darling and more. I'm Brian Lehrer.